The Guardian.
Hello, my name's David Brindle, and I'm The Guardian's Public Services Editor.
And I'm Jane Dudman, the Editor of Guardian Public, the website for senior public sector managers. And this is the Charity Effectiveness Podcast, brought to you by Society Guardian, in association with knowhownonprofit.org.
This month, it's all about leaders, the good, the bad, and the truly inspirational.
They normally lead by example, they listen. They don't micromanage.
He's really charismatic, gets on with everybody and has time for everyone, really listens.
We look back at the charity year, the recession, coalition government and the impact of the spending review.
The shock of the cuts, the speed with which they suddenly became a reality. I mean, I have never been in the sector and heard that kind of message, and I think most of us were pretty shell-shocked.
And we get your predictions for civil society in 2011.
That's all coming up on the Charity Effectiveness Podcast.
It was Henry Kissinger who said, "The task of the leader is to get his people from where they are to where they've not been."
And it was Groucho Marx who said, "Only one man in a thousand is the leader of men. The other 999 follow women." And as the charity and voluntary sectors are dominated by women staff, plus the fact that we're dominated by women here in the studio, it seems a fitting way to start us off.
Working in the third sector, there are specific challenges which leaders, our senior managers, our chief execs, face every day, whether it's enacting change and keeping supporters, staff and trustees on board, or just striving to bring in the funds in a difficult economic climate.
In this month's programme, we'll be looking at the qualities that make a successful leader in the charity and voluntary sector and what we should be doing to foster the leaders of the future.
As ever, we're joined by the creme de la creme of third sector leaders. Deborah Alcock-Tyler, Chief Executive of the Directorate of Social Change and author of It's Tough at the Top, The No-Fibbing Guide to Leadership. James Partridge, Founder and Chief Executive of Changing Faces, the leading UK charity supporting and representing people with disfigurements, and Caroline Beaumont, who's been working in the third sector for the past 6 years and has spent the last 12 months undertaking a CLAW Social Leadership Fellowship. She's soon to take up a new post as Director of Services and Business Development at REACH, the skilled volunteering charity. Hello to you all.
Hello. Hello.
So, Deborah, if I can come to you first, what do you see as the most common problems that leaders in the sector face?
I think the most common problem that leaders in the sector face is losing sight of the bigger picture of their organisation in the day-to-day struggle to survive. I think often what happens is they get so caught up in the drama and the anxiety of what's going on around them that they forget that there's a bigger picture. And also they forget that there is a tomorrow.
James, what do you think are the qualities that make a good leader in the charity and voluntary sector? And are these qualities different from other sectors like the public sector or the private sector?
Well, I think the thing that distinguishes the voluntary sector is very much that there are causes, and they're usually social causes, environmental causes, and so therefore the leader has to espouse those causes, speak for them, be charismatic about them, and so on, as well as doing all those things which have to be done to organise, manage a team, knit it together, motivate, and so on. I guess the distinction between voluntary and commercial is not a very easy one. If you talk to private sector people, they would say, "Well, I've got to champion my product, my service." Yes, but I think there is something distinctive about a cause. And also the other element is the philanthropy, which is usually required, although obviously in this world of social enterprise, there are funding streams now, but certainly the philanthropic nature of much of what we do. We have to appeal for monies.
Caroline, from people you've worked with and from your year as a CLAW Social Leadership Fellow, what values do you think are important for third sector leaders?
I think the CLAW Social Leadership Programme is based on a framework of leadership qualities, and many of those do apply equally to other sectors. The strand that I think is really particular to the sector is the one about working with and through others. And I remember hearing a story from a well-known charity chief exec who'd switched sectors and found that when he gave what he would have taken to be a direction in the public sector, it was taken as a sort of merely an interesting suggestion to be considered and rolled over. And I think when you try to wield that executive power, that's very rarely a successful tactic. So I think that ability to really kind of create those strategic conversations throughout the organisation, allow those to thrive and deal effectively with what might be seen in other sectors as dissent, but be able to harness that and channel that for positive good.
Well, there's been a fair bit of Twitter action on this in recent weeks, and we've been asking people who's inspired them in the sector. Suggestions have included the Green MP, Caroline Lucas, Walter Menzies, former chief exec of the Mersey Basin campaign, Claire Tickell of Action for Children, and Bob Holman, co-founder of the Easter House project in Glasgow.
So a few name checks there. But we've also been out and about asking the same question and finding out who inspires you.
My name is Katie Ann Dinsdale and I work at Sense, the national charity for deafblind people. My working life has been quite short so far, but I have had a few colleagues who've been very inspirational. They normally lead by example, they listen, they don't micromanage, and to me, those are the best leaders.
My name's Simon Wright. I work for Charity Builder, which is an online HR and health and safety tool, which is free of charge to charities. I think within the sector, I would name check Kevin Curley, who's the chief exec of NAVCA. I think they as an organisation, and he as a person, focus on a good mixture between inspiring and trying to set policy, but also getting things done, and I think that's clearly important.
My name is Lucy Caldicott. I'm from Click Sergeant. I would say one of the most inspirational people I've worked with is a man called Mark Goldring, who I worked for when I was at VSO. He's now chief executive of MenCap. And I think one of the most inspiring things about Mark is his ability to translate sometimes quite complex ideas into words and language that are very understandable. And I think for me that's something absolutely intrinsic to good leadership, is that ability to get ideas across with clarity and so really sort of translate the vision of the organisation for whoever needs to understand it.
My name's Matt Collins and I'm from Chance UK, which is a children's charity that mentors children with behavioural difficulties. I think the person that's inspired me most kind of as a leader and in every other way would have to be my dad, actually. He's inspired kind of my choice of career because we had a conversation, I think, when I was 10 years old, totally off the cuff, and he said that you should try and do a career that helps someone in some small way. And I've been in the voluntary sector for nearly 10 years now, so I know that the work I do for charities in some small way or another is helping people.
My name is Kath Kane and I work for an organisation called Standing Together at Domestic Violence. One of my key inspirations, I would say, is Tina Turner, partly because of exactly some of her life journeys and life struggles. And she came out of a very abusive relationship with Ike Turner. At 40, she had a chart-topping hit single and she's gone to inspire another few generations of people with her music. So she's definitely one of my inspirations.
So, Deborah, it's obvious there are great heroes working across charities and voluntary organisations now, but where are we going to find the leaders of the future?
We're going to find the leaders in the future in our volunteers. And actually, there's a big sort of move, isn't there, in the sector, in society, about getting young people engaged in volunteering. And, of course, entirely right, and, you know, young people are the future, blah, 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 blah. We know all that story. But I actually think that we massively underrate the value of older volunteers. And I think that it's going to surprise us that many of the charismatic, magnificent leaders of the future are actually going to be older people who come into volunteering and suddenly realise what a massive difference they can make.
James, you've had a big year. There's been a stint presenting the news on Channel 5 and you've won numerous accolades for your leadership, including the Beacon Prize for Leadership. So can you share with us, do you think, why you're doing so well?
Yeah, I'd like to feel that I could put my finger on it, but I probably can't. It's probably a mixture of something about leading from the front and leading from behind. I suspect that what I'm able to do just by getting into a room is to tell a story quite quickly with my face, and therefore that has the capacity to, you know, get it quickly to people. But I'm thinking that I can't do most of what I do without a team. And I think that I've managed to find a team around me that has enabled me to be, you know, effective and, if you like, you know, effective in leading the cause. So disfigurement and the face equality campaign and so on are now out there. They're much more public property than they were, say, 5 years ago.
Caroline, what barriers do you think there are for people moving up the ladder within charities and voluntary organisations? You had to take a whole year off to do your fellowship with the CLAW Leadership Programme, and that was quite a bold step to take.
I think as a sector we tend to value specialisms, and we tend to be quite nervous about singling people out for development, when what we really need to be doing is identifying the people who've got the potential to be great generalists and really getting serious about their progression and succession planning.
One thing we should perhaps address is the lack of diversity among third sector leaders and chief executives. There's still a very large divide between men and women at the top, and this margin increases as the size of the organisation gets bigger. Out of a pool of more than 750 chief executives who took part in a recent survey with Akivo, just 2% were from the BME community. Debbie Arrio is the founder and executive director of AFRICA, Africans Unite Against Child Abuse, a charity that advocates for the welfare of African children in the UK and Nigeria. She says help's needed to redress the balance.
In the UK today, it's quite difficult for many people from the ethnic minorities to find themselves in positions where they can actually influence change at the highest level. We do not have access to a variety of networks that would expose us to opportunities in these areas. So, for example, we find that most people are not able to make contact with friends who are already at that level and who can help them to also, you know, rise up to that level. So that's one major challenge that we face as a community. That's one of the key reasons why we're not seeing many people rising to that position.
Deborah, this issue of representation is something we've addressed before in the podcast. What do you see as the obstacles to us bringing diversity to the community of chief executives?
I'm afraid this is probably a bit counter-cultural, but I think often the obstacles are ourselves, not the environment that we're in. Of course there are barriers, but there are barriers for men, for women, for BME groups, for all sorts of people. And actually the biggest gift that we can give people is the confidence to go out and to fight those barriers themselves. I don't believe that you can take away, you know, whole swathes of sort of structural stuff and that's going to allow people to come forward. I think about, for example, the challenge of attracting diverse boards. Very often the problem is not that there's anything in the way, it's just that people don't apply. Why don't they apply? There's no barrier there. Often they don't apply because they don't have the inner sense and confidence that they can themselves.
Caroline, you're a young woman climbing the career ladder in the sector. How have you found this journey? Have there been particular gender challenges to moving up?
I can't say personally that I've found any gender challenges. One of my fellows is looking at the flip side of that and looking at why as a sector we are actually much better than the private sector about promoting our female leaders. So I actually think it's something that we should be celebrating.
The Akivo pay survey we mentioned earlier also found that 81% of sector leaders are actually imported in from either the public or the private sectors. Why is that, James?
Well, I think that we've got to recognise that some of the volunteers that Deborah mentioned are people who, during their working lives, see some issue, some cause that they really want to get a grip of. The School for Social Entrepreneurs is something that I'm really passionate about. And if you go there and see the people there, many of them are, you know, quote, mature people who are coming into the sector because they believe and they're bringing all their skills and talents to bear. And a lot of them are actually from BME communities. So I think we shouldn't be too negative about this. I think there's a really rising movement in the social enterprise area. The issue of funding is the key one for me, and the investment that is needed in that sector has to be released and made available.
I can see Deborah nodding.
Well, what I was going to say, actually, is it drives me completely nuts, to be honest, because bringing in people from the public and private sector, I think that often happens because for some reason, we in this sector, and particularly boards appointing senior staff, think that if you work in the voluntary sector, somehow you're not as good as someone who's come from the private or public sector. And it's absolute poop. In my experience, some of the most powerful, effective leadership behaviours happen in the voluntary sector. So actually, if it was me, I'd be doing it completely the other way around and looking internally first every time.
Given that, Deborah, given the hard times that the sector's facing, clearly there's not going to be a lot of money around to attract talent. Is that going to be a problem?
No, because really talented people who are committed to a cause couldn't give a stuff about the money. You look at the best people in the sector, honestly, some of them are so good, if they really wanted to earn shed loads of money, they could go and work in the private sector. Money is not the problem. If you want to work in the voluntary sector, you generally do it because you're passionate and you're committed. The money is the least concern. That is what's going to stop talent in the sector.
Caroline, your peers and your age group, are they driven by money in terms of career?
No, I don't think that's a main motivator. I think Deborah's right. I think if they really wanted to go for the big bucks, then they'd go and work in the private sector. And they could probably actually work in the sector and feel that they were having some social impact now as well, because the lines are becoming increasingly blurry. But I'd just like to also say, I think it's a bit of a myth that you need a big budget to develop people. You know, you just need to give people access to opportunity, exposure to different parts of the organisation, put some trust in them and coach them and support them to develop their careers internally.
Well, I would just add that that is ideal. I think a lot of public voluntary sector agencies right now are living in a very, very tight and constrained environment. And I would love to be able to say that that's what my team can have. But reality is we've got to be very focused on mission, program delivery and so on. And so that's the downside, I'm afraid.
Caroline, you mentioned leadership development there. And one of the interesting things about the sector is that the routes to leadership and the development of leaders is often rather ill-defined. Is it better to slog it out within a single organisation or to take a sideways move, go do an MBA, parachute back in at a higher level? Caroline?
I would like to say that the scope was there to develop within your organisation. I don't think it always is, but I think that we have a responsibility as aspiring leaders to really lobby for those opportunities to be created in our organisations.
Deborah?
In my experience, I've come across two kinds of leaders in the voluntary sector. There are cause-related leaders and there are career-related leaders. Both are equally valid, but what I've found that if you're a career-related leader, in fact, if you want just to be a chief executive and you don't mind too much what kind of organisation it is, then actually there are plenty of opportunities and you do need to move around organisations. But if you're a cause-related leader, I think you're going to get to the top anyway if you're absolutely that committed to the cause.
James?
I think the ideal is to have both and, where there is an opportunity within organisations to grow, but there's also a budget that allows people to go and experience, you know, outside, time off in lieu, and potentially sabbaticals and other things of that sort. I'm not sure that we're going to hear an awful lot more about that in this coming few years, I'm afraid.
Deborah?
And actually, one of the great things about learning your leadership craft in the voluntary sector is that most organisations are so small, you have to learn how to do absolutely everything. You have to be able to fix the plumbing, put the kettle on, do a strategic plan, understand the finance, fundraising and all the rest of it. You don't really get that so much in other types of sectors.
So plenty of things to think about there. And if you want to continue the debate, remember to check out The Guardian's new voluntary sector network, a new online space where professionals working in and with the voluntary sector can discuss and debate the issues which affect their professional lives and get advice and insight from peers and experts. You can find out more by going to guardian.co.uk/voluntary-sector-network.
So what have been your highlights or lowlights of the charity year? How about the change in government? The move from calling it the third sector to calling it civil society? The comprehensive spending review? Or perhaps the dissolution of Quangos?
Well, who better to give us their view of the year than Ian Bruce, president and founder of the Centre for Charity Effectiveness? He was surprised by the severity of the cuts and says we've all seen the big society before.
I think I can honestly say that this last year has been one of the most extraordinary I think I've experienced in the 35 plus I've been in the sector. And for me, the two big headlines have been cuts and the big society. I just think the shock of the cuts, the speed with which they suddenly became a reality. I mean, in the build-up to an election, one of the parties was almost sort of initially pretending that there wasn't really much of a problem, and the other one was going on about there were going to be some cuts. We suddenly have the election over, and we discover comes home to us that the Labour government would have reduced the deficit by a half in 4 years, and our new government is going to reduce it all by 4 years, and that's going to be 30% plus. I mean, I have never been in the sector and heard that kind of message, and I think most of us were pretty shell-shocked. But what was extraordinary for me and really quite uplifting was the speed with which people reacted. I mean, I was meeting people in July already who were talking about how they were going to handle 20%, 30% cuts, how they've made plans. But now the responsibilities and pressures are going to be growing and growing and growing each year as at local level, you know, each year of cuts comes in. I just think that has been the headline for me. It's the year of cuts. Even though they're not already implemented, the kind of stress and implementation planning has been enormous. And my second big headline that, from my perspective for this last year, is the big society. I mean, once again, this was an idea that, I mean, we kind of thought we heard people talking about, and to be honest, I think we're still not sure what it means, but it's clearly getting more serious by the day. I mean, the big society is going to be a challenge, not just for us, it's going to be a challenge for the government, because I've been through at least three and arguably four or even five attempts at big societies in the last 35 years from governments. They have all failed. And actually today I was interviewing a group of 15 people over the age of 70 as part of a kind of age concern interview. And I asked them about the big society. Interestingly, first of all, they said they'd never heard of it. But then we went back to the Second World War, as one often does with people in their 80s. And we concluded two major things. The first is that there was a big society in the war, but who wants those kind of circumstances repeated in order to create it? But the second thing, it was not just the external threat that created the big society, it was that the government intervened hugely, put massive resources in. And at the moment, as far as I can see, the government is seeing a big society on the lines of self-help, stand on your own 2 feet, much more Samuel Smiles, rather than mutual aid Kropotkin. I think the government's got a lot of thinking to do and may well be able to achieve it, but by gosh, it's a mountain to climb. So those, for me, are the two biggies from the last year, the cuts and big society. Now, what does that mean for the coming year? Well, once again, in my opinion, it means that absolutely top of the agenda for most non-profit organisations, especially charities, is going to be resources. And I deliberately say resources, not money, because I think we're going to be looking for resources everywhere we can get them. Money is obviously going to be top of the list because that's the most flexible resource that we can get. And I think we're going to be really concentrating on diversifying our income sources. But secondly, I think the whole area of volunteer and community involvement is going to be absolutely top of the tree because it fits with the big society paradigm. It also is an area where many organisations are not really very effective. And so I think we're going to see a lot of, especially charities, working very hard in the coming year, prioritising volunteer recruitment and support and development.
Ian Bruce there. So before we wrap up, we'd love to know what you think 2011 will bring. We haven't got a crystal ball to hand, but what's top of your to-do list as we plan for the year ahead? James.
Well, I think Ian Bruce got it pretty spot on by talking about resources top of the tree. I think Changing Faces is not heavily government funded, but we clearly are going to need to focus very, very hard on resources, you know, pro bono and funded, not least because it's so much more competitive. Everything is so much more competed for now because government funding is no longer there. Secondly, I think we've got to focus. We will be focusing even more on the uniquenesses that we have to offer, so USP focus. And thirdly, I think we don't want to lose the long vision. And I think this is the worry for a lot of us, that we're going to get trapped into, as Deborah was saying right early on, you know, God, it's today and today and tomorrow and it'll be desperate. I am determined that we should keep our eye on the bigger goals, the longer term vision of changing society. And it's going to be a balancing act to do that.
Caroline, are you playing the long game?
The priority for me when I joined REACH is on identifying really what skills the sector needs and how skilled volunteering can actually help the sector. And in doing that, I think we first need to look at, well, what are the major challenges today, and where a year ago maybe it would have been sustainability, today, I think, as Deborah mentioned, it's more likely to be survival. So what will the role of skilled volunteers be in helping to address that issue?
Deborah, survival?
I actually, for the sector as a whole, I think these cuts are a jolly good thing, frankly. I really do, because I think so much money has been shoveled into the sector, an awful lot of us have completely lost sight of what we're really there for. And what we're finding is lots of organisations having to go back to, what are we actually set up to do and what really matters? And actually, we'll be going back to normal. The voluntary sector is blooming good at what it does. We've dealt with cuts before. We never have any money, to be perfectly honest with you, and we know how to deal with it when we haven't got them. So I actually think that's a good thing. And in terms of big society, again, that's just the voluntary sector. All that's going to happen is that we're going to be able to show our values and our ways of behaving out through wider society. How can that be a bad thing? I think it's great.
James, do you think the cuts are going to take us back to our roots?
I think they focus a lot of people on, so what is it that we can really contribute? And particularly in bringing in volunteers, how can we utilise them? How can we listen to them? How can we empower them to go and do things which they may not have thought of doing? So it's an exciting time, but I think the underlying anxiety and uncertainty is unsettling for quite a lot of people, and I'm afraid that that will continue through 2011, hopefully not beyond that, hopefully.
Food for thought there. So thank you very much to our guests, Deborah Alcock-Tyner, James Partridge and Caroline Beaumont, for braving the cold and coming to the studio. And if you want to hear more from Deborah on issues about leadership in the sector, she'll be at the Cass Centre for Charity Effectiveness on January the 26th for a talk entitled Courageous Leadership, Pioneering Work in Dangerous Situations. Our thanks also to Ian Bruce, Debbie Ario and our varied contributors from Twitter.
And as we tear the last page out of the diary or click on the last screen of Outlook for 2010, we ask, what are your personal ambitions for the year ahead?
I'm excited about the royal wedding. and I'm hopeful for a general election and that the coalition government doesn't work and we can have a general election and get a bit more stability.
I'm a recent graduate. I want to show other graduates that there is hope out there and you just have to kind of go that extra mile, and a bit of luck does help, but also try and keep on trying.
My highlight of the year is that obviously you can't see this on a podcast, but I'm heavily pregnant, so I'm very much looking forward to the imminent arrival.
Well, you never know what's around the corner, but I'm in a band called Tiny Birds, and we really want to put out our album in the new year, and we want to be gaining popularity and writing better songs. And I don't know, I think sort of as I get older, that I want to make sure that my view on the world is as good as it could be, because, you know, you can try and change the world as much as you can, but you will always have a sort of limited impact. But I think the impact you can have on yourself and your own outlook and your own mental well-being and your own emotional well-being is almost limitless if you kind of put enough time and effort into it. And so, you know, if that's not too spiritual or deep, then that's something I'll be paying a lot of attention to sort of in the year ahead.
So the best of luck to Matt Collins from Chance UK, the very pregnant Zoe MR from LASA, Katie Ann Dinsdale from Sense, and Adiza Tachani from the Funding Network. I'm Jane Dudman, the editor of Guardian Public, the website for senior public sector managers.
And I'm David Brindle, the Guardian's public services editor, and you've been listening to the Charity Effectiveness podcast, brought to you by Society Guardian in association with knowhownonprofit.org and produced by Sound Delivery. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.